This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett. Heard every Sunday night from 11 p.m. to 1 a.m. on Zoomer Radio, the new AM 740. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett. Heard every Sunday night from 11 p.m. to 1 a.m. on Zoomer Radio, the new AM 740.
Hey, thanks for inviting me into your home. And believe me, I take that responsibility and honor very seriously. And thanks for listening. Wherever you are, perhaps you're listening in on AM 740, Zoomer Radio, our flagship station right here in Toronto. 50,000 watts of love, peace, and truth coming at you. You may be listening in on one of our growing list of affiliates in the U.S. I believe we are closing in on about three dozen affiliates. We just added Myrtle Beach in the last couple of weeks. We're very excited about that. It's an FM station, which is great. You may be listening in on the podcast at iTunes. You can also subscribe through zoomerradio.ca. It's also available at Stitcher Radio, TalkZone.com, and of course, through our very own app, the Conspiracy Show app, which is now available at iTunes and Google Play. So it's good for your iPhone, your Android, and now you can take The Conspiracy Show with you wherever you go. So wherever you're listening in and however you're listening in, it's great to have you aboard, and thank you. Very excited about tonight's show, as usual. But this next guest, I have been trying to track her down for quite some time, and she is so busy. She's always on the go. And she has her irons, as I say, in a lot of fires. Mary Sutherland is an author, a researcher, focusing her work on consciousness studies, ancient history, and unusual phenomena. She's really a hands-on researcher and the creator of one of the world's largest websites on the internet. It's got hundreds of pages providing information on the paranormal, UFOs, ancient races and their cultures, sacred sites and PowerPoints of the world. The website, incidentally, is called burlingtonnews.net. burlingtonnews.net. You want to check it out. Did I mention she's also investigating underground tunnels and cave systems and dimensional worlds, and she's into metaphysics and everything? Mary Sutherland is into everything. Now, get this. The governor of Kentucky actually commissioned her as a Kentucky colonel. That's an honorary appointment for her work on the ancient sites of Kentucky. And we'll talk about that. All her spelunking adventures down there. Now, for the last 5 years, she has been exploring, mapping, and documenting the ancient underwater structures of Rock Lake near Aztlan. And for the last 14 years, she's been documenting the ancient sites around Burlington, Wisconsin. Now, Burlington, Wisconsin, I don't know. It's one of these places. It might be a portal, perhaps. Perhaps the veil there is getting very thin. I don't know. But something about Burlington, Wisconsin, it's a good place for Mary Sutherland to be because they have just such a wide assortment of paranormal activity there, including UFOs. It reminds me a little bit of the Skinner Ranch and also parts of the Hudson Valley that Rosemary Ellen Guiley has been on the program to talk about. Just so much happening in and around Burlington, Wisconsin. Regardless, truth is Mary's passion, and she believes it's through truth that we'll break ourselves free of our present entanglements in life. She says that when we become free, we will create our own personal story of the hero's journey, which is, of course, suggested by Joseph Campbell. And she's such a person. She's a natural-born networker, and all she does, from her Burlington Vortex conferences and Sci-Fi Cafe to her public talks and published books, including her latest, which we're going to talk about, The Red-Haired Giants. Mary Sutherland, how are you? Welcome to The Conspiracy Show.
Well, thank you for having me on. I've been looking forward to this.
Likewise. Ma, you have a lot of irons in the fire. And before we get started, I just want to mention a couple of conferences coming up. One of them is the Chicago Dark Shores Ghost Conference. That's happening in October. What else is going on?
And then Stuart Swerdlow up in Michigan is also having a conference, and I'll be there as one of the main speakers the 9th through the 11th.
As I said, you cover a lot of topics, but one I want to hone in on briefly off the top, the subject of your new book, The Red-Haired Giants. I've been fascinated by giants. I've done a number of shows on it, The Mound Builders. Even Abraham Lincoln on a trip to Niagara Falls. Mentioned the ancient giants. He alluded to giants that may be in those mounds. You were dubbed a Kentucky colonel by the governor of Kentucky for your work in Kentucky. What, excavating these mounds? What are you doing in Kentucky?
Well, what we were doing there was we were looking for evidence of Atlantis. And we actually found a lot of evidence. We actually found a temple up on top of a high mountain. It took us like 3 hours to climb through briar bushes and facing rattlesnakes or whatever, but we finally got to the top and we found it. There was a temple of the sun up there as well as a temple of the moon. And then underneath the temple of the sun, there was a cave. And you could see that there had been steps carved down, going down into the cave. And the whole side of that wall just glimmered with silver. Just an amazing sight. And you could see, the carved blocks, and we found statues and statuettes and a lot of Mayan stuff.
Really?
But, of course, the mound builders were the precursors to the Mayan and the Aztec civilizations.
Well, let's talk about these red-haired giants and evidence for them. There's, of course, if you go into the archives of reputable newspapers, like the New York Times and other local newspapers, just replete of stories of discoveries of these giant skeletal remains.
Right, around the world.
Yes, and particularly here in our own backyard, here in North America. And yet, we don't see these on exhibit at the Smithsonian or anywhere else. First of all, give me some examples of evidence that you've come across in your research that would tend to suggest that this continent was at one time inhabited by this race of giants.
Well, there's a lot of written evidence, as you mentioned, and with my book, The Red-Haired Giants, I focus on a lot of the ancient texts. And I went into, once you know the ancient name of North America, it's not really that difficult to start finding information. And at one point in time, North America was called Pushkara.
Hmm.
And through Pushkara, that's Brahman. And that takes you right to the Mahabharata and the Vedic text.
Right, right.
And in the Mahabharata, it speaks about the giants, the sorcerers or the Nagas, the serpent people of North America, called at that time Pushkara. They also called it Atala.
And when
A-T-A-L-A.
And when do you suppose these red-haired giants landed on our shores?
Well, I'm putting together a new book. It's hopefully be out in the next couple months, and I'm going to go in further detail from my book, The Red-Haired Giants. But we can date these people, right to Atlantis, of course, in the Battle of the Gods, we know that Troy now exists, right?
Sure.
And at one point in time, they said that Troy was just a myth. And, when you go into the Battle of Troy, you realize, after you start studying it, you realize that that was part of the Atlantean War, which was the War of the Gods. The Titan Wars.
Right, right.
And the Titans, of course, was giants.
Well, we'll tie it together with Atlantis in a few moments, but I want to just remind listeners Mary Sutherland is with us, and her website, burlingtonnews.net, fabulous website, just filled with hundreds and hundreds of pages of information for those of you that are into basically anything alternative, ancient wisdom, and right now we're focusing on her new book, The Red-Haired Giants. Mary will be appearing in Chicago at the Dark Shores Ghost Con in October. So the accounts that I have read And these skeletal remains discovered in these, not only in burial mounds, but also in caves. Some of these individuals as 8 feet tall and more. What can you tell me about anything unusual about them? Like, did they double rows of teeth? I've read about that. An extra digit on each hand and each foot.
Right. And then you had asked me earlier about the evidence. We have giant skeletal remains that have been found in Delavan, Wisconsin. We've also found these giant skeletal remains in the Atzillon area, which is like Lake Mills, Wisconsin, over there by Rock Lake. And so, you know, we do have the skeletal remains to prove here in Wisconsin, you know, that these giants walked the earth, and they were the mound builders.
And, are these on exhibit somewhere? Where would we go and see these?
Well, unfortunately, they're not on exhibit anymore. We've got the pictures, you know, that was taken, and I'll be showing them in my upcoming book. This one, though, I actually do have some evidence of my own. Through excavations, you know, I've gotten like petrified fingers, you know, just small remains of these giants. But I do actually have some artifacts here that I'm going to have on display at the Swerdlow Conference. And it's going to be the first time they've ever been exhibited.
Oh, fascinating! And I was correct when I said two double rows of teeth and six digits.
Double rows of teeth, the six fingers, you know, on their hands, each hand, and six on their toes, you know.
All right, we are coming. And we're coming up on a break here, Mary. Let me ask you a quick question, and then we'll get to it after the break. And that is, we do have people that are exceptionally tall. I'm not sure what percentage of the population, but we have, of course, you know, people playing professional basketball that are, you know, upwards to seven feet tall. How do we differentiate this race of giants from just, tall, you know, extraordinarily tall individuals or a genetic mutation?
Actually, that's our living proof of these giants, because that their height, their double rows of teeth, you know, the six digits, that's brought on, and the red hair, that's all brought on by a recessive gene.
All right, we'll take a time out, come back. Mary Sutherland, the red-haired giants right here on The Conspiracy Show. Don't go away. Mary Sutherland stays with us, and the website again is burlingtonnews.net. What's happening with the Sci-Fi Cafe? You're moving.
No, we moved.
Oh, you have moved
actually.
Now. You have moved.
We closed that down in March, and we relocated to Winslow, Illinois, which is about 2 hours from Burlington. But we still do our tours there in Burlington and carry on some of our work. We're doing just about everything we always did, except we just don't have the cafe open. Because, I wanted to dedicate more time to my research and the writing of my books.
Right.
And the cafe took up 7 days of our, 7 days a week, and we'd done it for like 10 years. So, you know, it was just time to kind of close down that chapter and start a new one.
Wisconsin is certainly a hotbed for these mounds. We're talking about the mound builders and the red-haired giants. It's interesting because on the shores of I believe it's Lake Superior. And that would border on Wisconsin, I believe.
It does.
There is supposedly, I've never been there, but I've heard tale of a huge copper mining operation that goes back, obviously, pre-Columbus. Were the red-haired giants involved in that at all?
They were, as well as Solomon, because a lot of the copper that was mined from there actually went for the purpose of the building of Solomon's temple.
Wow. So we are talking about the ancient Israelites. We are talking about that far back.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because the Bronze Age that took place in Europe, not enough copper in Europe that would have explained, you know, that a revolution, really. So that copper had to come from probably the shores of Lake Superior, correct?
Well, when they shut down the copper mines here, you know, in the Michigan, Wisconsin area, that ended the Bronze Age.
Isn't that fascinating?
Because
one has to wonder how the size of the... Go ahead.
We were producing the purest copper in the world and the most. So, yeah, that's where that all that that's what. That's what ended the Bronze Period.
And think of the size of the vessels crossing the Atlantic, how large they would have had to have been in order to carry all of that copper over there. And what year are we talking about, roughly? What era?
Well, you know, that's the big question, isn't it? I kind of stand by the 10,500 BC. It was all still going, or it was all going on. You know, and what the date for Solomon and his temple, you know, mining the copper at that point of time, I mean, that's always been up in the air, you know, as far as the date goes for Solomon. But, I just can't tell you when the mining date would have been for Solomon, but
right.
I do know that they were mining 10,500 years ago.
And these red-haired giants, there are accounts of them by the Native Americans. What did they call? What did they call them?
Oh, geez. The Indians in this area called them the Hokadesh, and which. And they describe them as giants with red hair, and that were the population as thick as the leaves on the trees.
The population
and
is
builders,
wow.
And builders of stone, which would indicate that they were also. And we have found pyramids in this area, so we do know that they were actually building pyramids and stone temples as well.
Wow, a population as thick as the
leaves. And not only did they have earthen mounds, but they were also had stone mounds.
Interesting.
Very few in existence anymore, but the stone mounds actually predated the earthen mounds.
Were they a warrior race? Were they a warrior civilization?
They didn't see. I don't really think that they were, but they had the weaponry, you know, to protect themselves. A lot of their cities had these walls built around them, you know, for protection from, warring tribes that was coming across, because there was a great migration coming out of Asia, and they ended up. Exterminating a lot of the mound builders or forcing them south down into Mexico. So, you know, there was battles, but I think that they were more of a peaceful type of a people, had the ability to protect themselves. But, you know, and there was, like I said, there was wars that broke out. And that's what my book, The Red-Haired Giants, is about the extermination of, you know, the extermination of these people and their migration down into Mexico and Central America, South America, where they started up the Aztec and the Mayan civilizations.
How could a group of people that were so physically so huge, and presumably there would be strength to go along with that size. I mean, I've heard legends of them being able to pull trees out from their roots, but I don't know if that's apocryphal or not. I mean, you would think that they would have been formidable, a formidable enemy if someone had tried to take them on.
Oh, they were. But, you know, the enemy was also formidable, you know. And, you know, there was more of these people coming in that migrating into North America, and there was just too many of them, you know, for them to fight. And so they eventually just gave up, you know, and started moving south.
With that,
and there was a complete extermination of these red-haired giants here in North America, or they tried to completely exterminate them, but they wasn't successful at it. But they did manage to get them out of North America, down into Mexico and South America, Central America.
Mary Sutherland is with us, author, researcher, the website burlingtonnews.net, and we've linked up to that at richardserrett.com. Just click on Mary's name, and that'll take you right there. It's an impressive website, all sorts of information. I mentioned earlier about Abraham Lincoln. This was before he was president. In fact, I think he was campaigning for another president, and he made the trip up to Niagara Falls, New York, and made there a very interesting speech talking about how, you know, spectacular the falls were, and mentioned how the eyes of the you know, the denizens of those burial mounds once looked upon those falls. Presumably he was talking about these giants.
Right.
Now, some people have you know, tried to explain that away by saying, well, what he really meant was the mastodon. But I mean, are we finding mastodon bones in great numbers in these areas? Are we finding mastodon bones in these burial mounds?
Well, North America did have mastodons, and as a matter of fact, a lot of people make the mistake and they think that the Kennewick man is the oldest man to date, you know, here in North America. But here in Kenosha, Wisconsin, they found the skeleton of a mastodon in the basement of a museum, and they found cut marks on the mastodon.
Mm-hmm.
And so they realized that the mastodon had been hunted by, you know, this early man. And so they brought people in, you know, to do some testing of the bones, you know, and, you know, carbonating the bones and that, and found out, or, you know, they came to the conclusion that the date of these people predated even the Kennewick man, thus making, you know, evidence to show that the earliest evidence of, you know, man was right here in Wisconsin.
Right.
But that doesn't mean, you know, that there was that these type of people didn't spread out through the whole United States. It just means that, you know, the earliest dating of man was right here in Wisconsin.
Sure.
But yeah, but they did have mammoth. But what Lincoln was talking about, he was talking about the giants, human giants.
He was a bit of a giant himself.
And even Thomas Jefferson talked about the giants.
Oh, is that right? I didn't know. Tell me.
Yeah.
Tell me more about that.
Yeah, he was basically the first archaeologist, and he did a lot of excavation of these earthen mounds, and they were finding giant bones in there, giant human bones. So he was basically the first one to write about them, you know, and do archaeological reports.
I would imagine,
and I think that a lot of that that Lincoln came across was something that was based off some of the reports that he had read about, you know, from Thomas Jefferson.
Interesting. I would imagine it is very difficult, if not nearly impossible now, to excavate these mounds today. And I'm guessing that may have something to do with, you know, the Native Americans, obviously, not wanting, perhaps they're laying claim to these and not wanting them to be desecrated or disturbed. Is that a reasonable assessment?
That, you can't get into these mounds at all. And I don't think even the archaeologists can really dig into these mounds anymore. You know, they have to use those you know, what those X-rays, you know, or I don't know what they call them, you know, that goes over the ground, you
sure.
know, and,
yep.
you know, they can, you know, get get some sort of an idea of what's underneath the ground. I can't think of the name of what those, you know, that equipment is. But, I don't think that they can really do the digs themselves either, you know. But I don't think it's because of them, you know, whoever it is that's made this decision about it, I don't think that they're really so concerned about the mounds being desecrated as much as the discovering the information.
Right, right.
You know, what lays underneath the ground.
Yes, indeed, what lays beneath. And well, that brings us around to the Lollapalooza question, which is, again, you know, these earlier reports from the New York Times. Again, I invite people to go to the archives and check this out for themselves. Correspondence between archaeologists and the directors of various museums and so forth, saying this is what we found, and there is a paper trail, and yet none of these remains are on display. What's preventing them? I ask rhetorically.
Well, one thing I keep kicking myself over and over and over, because I had the Sci-Fi Cafe and I just couldn't take the time. I thought I couldn't take the time, and I should have. But I got a call from this museum, from a curator down in Mexico, saying that they had human giant bones, and they wanted me to go down there, you know, do a documentary on it. And crazy of me is I told them I couldn't do it because I was stuck at the cafe.
Oh, Mary.
Which was crazy, yeah. And I've been, okay, you know, for years now, I have been kicking myself for it.
It may not be too late. Listen, I am late for a break, though. We'll take a time out. We'll come back, and we have to pursue that. Mary Sutherland was with us, BurlingtonNews.net. I'm back with more right here on The Conspiracy Show. My name is Richard Serrett. We are back with Mary Sutherland. Mary, this is a short break, but I do want to pick up on that. You got an invitation from, this was a museum down in Mexico.
Right.
And they are in possession of the remains of one of these red-haired giants.
Right.
They invited you down, and you were kind of busy, but what other details did they get?
Out of my mind is what I was, you know, because for years I've been kicking myself for it, and I even lost the email on it. But I was talking to somebody today about it, and now that I don't have the cafe and I have more time for my research, what I want to do is go into all my, because I always save all my emails, so I'm thinking about maybe going, you know, doing a search for this museum, getting a hold of the curator again, and then go down there, you know, because, you know, that was an opportunity of a lifetime, and I blew it.
Well, I don't know. Don't be so sure. You know, they're not going anywhere, hopefully. But I want to circle back to my original question about the conspiracy to suppress this information. These skeletal remains, if the Native American accounts that they were so numerous, you know, they rivaled the leaves on the tree, we are talking about millions, perhaps millions of skeletal remains. I mean, where are they? They've got to be. They were boxed up and shipped off somewhere. Are they sitting in a big warehouse somewhere, or if you went to the Smithsonian, do you think they're hiding them in the back?
Oh, I'm sure that somebody's got these bones someplace, you know, and I mean, there's got to be a lot of them someplace, and they're hidden, you know, hidden from our sight. And, you know, it's not just the history of the giants. I mean, you know, for some reason, our government just, you know, it's like they run the whole thing like the military need to know basis. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, we have UFO sightings. Well, you know, they don't give us the information on UFOs. Paranormal, they don't give us any validation on, you know, anything, you know, paranormal. They don't give us validation on the cryptids, and they don't give us validation on, you know, our history. You know, it's just, they just won't tell us anything. You know, regardless, you know, if it's UFOs, the paranormal, cryptozoology, you know, ancient history, you know, it's kind of left up to us researchers, you know, to get out there and find these missing pieces that they might have overlooked, you know, and then try to put these pieces together and, you know, and come up with some sort of a story.
Well, therein lies, I guess, the rationale for keeping a lid on these skeletal remains, because they do not fit the official narrative that's sort of been spoon-fed us right out of the Encyclopedia Britannica.
Right. Well, you know, thank God, you know, that we have authors now, you know, that print on demand, you know, printing, you know, self-publishing authors and that, because I remember a time that, you know, an author would have to write a book and then submit it to a publisher. The publisher would only take so many types of books if it fit into the agenda, you know. And then if you managed to get a book published, then it would go to a library, and then the library would censor it. So, I mean, up until we had the Internet, we were very, very limited to any information. And now, you know, we've got all these authors such as myself out there digging around, getting information, putting together books, you know, and getting it out there, you know, for people to read. But, you know, I remember that time that it was very limited, you know, prior to the Internet of anything that we were able to read.
Sure.
And it was very controlled as to what we were able to read as well.
Yeah, and we better watch it. It may be controlled again if we're not careful.
Well, if they had their choice, it would be.
Sure. It is giving them fits, as you say, the amount of information, the kinds of information now available to people that are very hungry for the truth, whatever that might be. Mary Sutherland is with us.
And you're right. The people are very hungry for the truth because they know that the history that's been given to them is not true.
All right. We're going to head into a break shortly. But when we come back, I do want to talk about Atlantis and your work in Kentucky, dubbed a Kentucky Colonel, no less, by the governor for her work there. Mary Sutherland, author, researcher. We've been talking about the red-haired giants, the mound builders. And we will talk Atlantis when we come back right here on The Conspiracy Show. My name is Richard Serrett. Don't go away. BurlingtonNews.net, that's the website, if you want to find out more about Mary Sutherland. And we're talking about this ancient giant race responsible for building these mounds that really dot the continent. They're all over Wisconsin, places like all up and down the Ohio Valley. Who knows, you know, how many farmers, perhaps even up here in Canada, have just underneath their feet are the remains of this incredible ancient race of red-headed giants. There is a connection with these beings to the ancient civilization of Atlantis. Let's talk a little bit about that and what Kentucky has to do with Atlantis. Pray tell. Tell me more.
Oh, okay. Well, they talk about a flood, right? And they talk about the mountains rising. So going with the idea of, you know, high water level and mountains, you know, people taking refuge, you know, the survivors taking refuge on these mountains, I thought that it would be a great place to look for temples, ancient Atlantean temples. And so I went, you know, I knew of this one treasure hunter down in Kentucky that he had contacted me about finding some engravings, you know, on the walls. And I looked at it, and it looked like it was Olga. So I thought, and I told my husband, I says, let's go on down to Kentucky and check that out, because I have a feeling that we're going to find some ancient civilizations, you know, or remnants of an ancient civilization down there. So we went down there, and we found it, you know, and we found the caves, you know, with the steps leading down into this cave system. We found a temple of the sun. We found this temple of the moon. There was a bust we found, and it was, let me think. It was probably about 3 foot tall, maybe about two and a half foot wide, and it was of an ancient serpent priest king. And we know it was white, you know, Caucasian, because the bust showed a mustache. But it also showed a headpiece where the very center of the headpiece was a serpent. You know, the head of a serpent like a cobra?
Right.
And then falling to the right, I believe, of it was the scale. It looked like scales of a snake skin. And on the opposite side was a feather. And, if, you know, you put it together, you know, there's a feathered serpent, which is Quetzalcoatl.
Right, Quetzalcoatl, that's right.
Yeah. And so, anyhow, I took a bunch of pictures of the bust and myself with the bust, and I put it in my book. Well, it's in the book Red Haired Giants, as well as my other book, Revelations. But like I said, we also found statues that they looked Mayan. But and then we found like discs there too that had like on one side of the disc was like I'm trying to think of what it was. It was like a panther or a cat,
right?
Depicted on one side of the disc, and on the other side of the disc was depiction of a person's face.
Hmm. Now you mentioned
a lot of interesting artifacts we found down there.
Right, but how explain to me the connection between Quetzalcoatl, who is a Mesoamerican deity. You mentioned the feathered serpent. That's what the name means. What does that have to do? Why do we make the connection between the Mayans and the Atlanteans?
Because the people that here of North America were Atlantean. There used to be, at one point in time, there used to be this large sea that ran through the central part of the United States, which connected to Canada and to Mexico. And on one side of the sea was, in the California area, that side, was where the Lemurians lived. And then on the other side of the sea was where, where the Appalachian Mountains are on that side of North America. That's where the Atlanteans lived. And anyhow, the Atlanteans, they became, as their civilization was going on, that's when the War of the Gods took place. And there was, and mankind was caught right in the middle and, had to choose sides, and fight for the gods. And there was thermonuclear warfare, and to the point where they said that it's written that the skies caught on fire. And it caused an imbalance in the magnetics of Earth, which caused a polar flip, and which brought on the deluge, the Great Flood. And now the survivors were because I said that the Atlanteans were there, Lemurians were there, and then when the deluge hit, most people were killed off, but the survivors, of the Atlanteans, they were what we know today as the ancient mound builders.
And where did they come from? I mean, you mentioned,
they were
the gods.
See, I'll stand by what I've said, that the North America was the motherland. There, in my book, Lost in Time, I talk about it. And I have the references of where I find all my literature. But what happened is the Lemurians set their people, the gods of wisdom, from North America. They sent them to various places around the world to reestablish colonies, as did the Atlanteans. And even the Egyptian history tells about Thoth.
Yes.
Coming from the western land across the sea. Well, if you look at a map, right across the sea from Egypt to the west is North America. It's not Europe, it's North America. So anyhow, we've got more than enough, which I show in my book, we have more than enough to prove that North America was the motherland. But then time lapsed, and eventually North America was pretty much lost to the memory. Mm-hmm. And then eventually, you know, people started coming across the sea again, and it North America was found. And but it was kept a great secret, you know, by the Phoenicians because of the fact that there it was, you know, they were trading, you know, the resources, the natural resources of North America were so great, you know, with gold and copper and you know, lumber, you know, and so they didn't want other people to know about this country. So they kept it secret, and they made up stories about sea monsters, and, you know, at the horizon was the end of the world, you know, and if you take your ship over there, then what would happen is you would, you know, go off the rim there,
right.
You know. And so they put all these scare tactics out there, you know, just kind of like what they do today, you know, put the fear in God, you know, of these people to travel to North America. So they pretty much had North America to themselves for a long time. But they also made maps, you know, and eventually as the Phoenicians died out and, you know, new civilizations, you know, kind of took over, some of these people found those old maps. And one of the people that found the old maps was Columbus, because with Columbus, remember the old nursery rhyme, what was it, in 1492?
Columbus sailed the ocean blue, right?
And that's what we were taught in school. But they never told us that there was a third line to that, and story. So what it really says is 1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue to see if the old maps were true.
Ah, fascinating. There you go. We're learning stuff right here.
Yeah.
But we're almost out of time, Mary, but I did want to ask you this. I had Dr. Melba Ketchum on the program a couple of weeks ago talking about the Sasquatch Genome Project, and I'm wondering whether, do you think that Sasquatch may be remnants of this ancient race of red-haired giants?
Well, I think, from my work, my research, I have found that we can trace Bigfoot right back to the epics of Gilgamesh and Enkidu. Are you familiar with that?
Certainly familiar with Gilgamesh, not so much
Enkidu.
Yeah,
because Gilgamesh was a giant, you know, a ruler, you know, during the days of the Sumerians. And anyhow, as the story goes, he was lonesome and he needed a companion to match his size. And so the goddess went to the forest and found the giant hairy beast that they called Enkidu. And his job was always to watch over the forest and over nature. But the goddess talked Enkidu into leaving his world of nature, the forest, and to join up with Gilgamesh. And then, of course, the whole epic of Gilgamesh is about him, and Gilgamesh, and Enkidu, and their battles that they fought, you know, taking over lands and that. And one day, they lost the certain battle. I can't remember which one it was, but anyhow, God punished Gilgamesh and Enkidu, his punishment was to be sent into inner earth. You know,
sounds like the story of Adam and Eve, doesn't it?
Enkidu said that he would never have anything to do with man again, and by the description in the Epic of Gilgamesh, that is Bigfoot. So I think that Bigfoot was a humanoid type of person, you know, like Gilgamesh, except, you know, Gilgamesh looked like a giant human. He looked like a, you know, giant ape or hairy beast, you know, but was human. And they evolved together, you know, but they went separate ways.
Fascinating.
And remnants of Enkidu, you know, and his people still exist today. And as Enkidu had stated, they will never coexist, you know, or work with man again.
Hence,
and that's what they do.
They find them,
but they don't have anything to do with man.
Mary Sutherland, a real pleasure speaking with you tonight. Thank you for this.
Oh, you're welcome.
And we should
thank you for having me on your show.
We should mention again, you'll be appearing at Chicago's Dark Shores Ghost Con, October 2015. And the website, again, is burlingtonnews.net. We'll do it again sometime. Thank you.
Yeah, and be sure, everybody, to purchase my book, The Red-Haired Giants. You can find it on Amazon.
Indeed. Thank you so much, Mary.
Well, thank you for having me.
All right.
Bye.
Good night. There she goes, Mary Sutherland. All right, my website is richardserrett.com. Let me spell the last name for you. S as in Simon. Y, because I love you. R-E. T as in Tom, T as in Tom. richardserrett.com, that's your portal to The Conspiracy Show. Hey, say hello on Twitter at Richard Serrett. And as always, follow the truth. Welcome to the Audio Imaginarium. My name is Richard Serrett, and this is indeed The Conspiracy Show. Congratulations, you found us. Come on inside and sit a spell. You are among friends. I'm so thankful for your company. We have a new addition to the program. Our new engineer, our new technical producer, Ian Robertson. Welcome aboard. You are I believe you are my fifth technical producer. So you've got big shoes to fill. Tim Spreen was a good one, and we wished him well, of course. And as always, Albert Vinzel, our story producer, is here, and he has posted his usual assortment of fascinating stories and tidbits in the slide carousel up on the website, richardserrett.com. So get on up there. And while you're there, click on that blue member button on the left-hand side. And register. Become a member. It's easy. It's free. And it's very fast. Once you're a member, you gain access to member area-only areas like the past show audio archive, which goes all the way back as far as the summer of 2012. Again, that's the website, richardserrett.com. And speaking of the summer, where has it gone? I tell you, I hope wherever you are enjoying yours. I know we are spending a lot of evenings at the beach at Bluffers Park Beach, just east of here in Toronto, on Lake Ontario. Beautiful. We go just as the sun is going down. It's cool. It's not crowded. We have a nice little bonfire, roast some weenies. It's just been idyllic, I have to tell you, enjoying the summer with the twins and the mighty Aphrodite. It's been a while since our next guest has been with us, and we are delighted to have him back. He was a regular contributor on the program for quite a while, and then he got busy with other things, but he has set aside an hour to sit down with us tonight and talk biblical prophecy. Our good old friend, media scientist Nelson Thal is here, and you may not be aware, but he is a Bible scholar, and we're very excited to have him with us again. Hey, Nelson, how are you, my friend?
Excellent, Richard. It's great being here again.
It's been a while.
Yes.
Listen, you, as I mentioned in the introduction, are a, I consider you to be a Bible scholar. I learned so much listening to you when we chat off the air and when we had dinner and so forth. We had dinner tonight. Very knowledgeable in this area. We have you on the program often to talk about assassinations and in your capacity as a media scientist and so forth. But tonight we are going to delve into biblical prophecy. And 2017, according to many Bible researchers, it could be lights out. This could be the big one, right? This could be end times fulfilled, 2017. What is your research and your investigations into Bible prophecy tell you?
Well, of course, the interesting thing is that there's the preface to our remarks and the prerequisite is we're saying that the Bible is from Genesis to Revelation is the Word of God, and this is a book written for men by God, and all the other books are written by men. So I think that's, first of all, a prerequisite to understand that. People have to accept the Bible as the Word of God to begin with.
All right.
So that's a prerequisite to our discussion. Now, given that this – you go into the Bible, and if you take a look at Genesis 5 and 7, there's all the necessary data and information that you can determine the number of years from creation week right through to today.
In other words, from Genesis, the clock is ticking. Mankind is given an allotted time. And what is the allotted time?
Right. 6,000 years. A thousand year a day for each 1,000 years and 1,000 years for a day.
It says we get 6,000 years right there in Genesis.
Basically in the Bible. Genesis and it's not in any one place. It's here a little, as it says, and there a little.
All right.
So you have to put it together, but it's all there.
Okay, so 6,000 years.
Six days of the week, and then 1,000 years, a millennium, a rest day, just as we have a six-day work week, and then we're off for a day.
Right, okay. So how do we – when do we start the counter? When do we start the 6,000 years?
Well, the 6,000 years starts when man was given free rein to do his own thing, which was the day he was put out of the garden.
All right.
And that was 3,983 B.C.
How do we know that precisely, Nelson?
Well, we know that because from Genesis 5 and 7, all the Genesis from Adam – right through eventually, not only Genesis 5, Genesis 7, but also with Matthew, we have all family line.
The genealogy.
The genealogy.
Right.
From Adam right through to Christ.
Okay. And we know that he lived approximately 2,000 years ago. So if you add up, you know, Methuselah was X number of years old, Noah was X number of years old. If we add up the genealogies
right
up to the time of Christ plus 2,000 years, we arrive at...
We know that 3,983 years B.C. was the creation, and so 6,000 years is up in 2017. Christ was born, by the way, Saturday, September the 20th, 4 B.C., and he was resurrected Saturday, April 28th, 31 A.D. And these dates are not difficult to calculate from knowledge of the Bible. Now, so we've got 2017 coming up as the 6,000-year point. Man is given 6,000 years by the Creator to do his own thing, to try and rule the planet according to the laws that the Lord laid down for him to follow, which, of course, he's rejected. So it's interesting.
Do you think?
Yeah.
My word.
Yeah. Out of 6,000 years, I mean, there's never any peace. There's just a period of rearmament of about 230 years, by the way, the calculations show. So out of 6,000 years, there's very little time when man's been had true peace.
Right, right.
So we've got the 6,000 years are going to be allotted. So up until 2017, there's going to be no second coming up until that date, because that would interfere with God's plan. He's allotted 6,000 years.
But before we get from here
right
to Armageddon or the end, you know, the end times,
right,
we have to go through Jacob's troubles, right?
Yeah.
Is what, 6 years?
Well, it's not necessarily detailed. We're not told necessarily how long Jacob's trouble is, because in many ways the birthright blessing gets withdrawn from Jacob, and we see that slowly happening because
it's 5 years or 3 years. We should be well into Jacob's troubles then, right?
Yes, we should be.
The sorrows.
Before the beginning of sorrows. I mean, World War I. Remember, the Creator says that he is going to use Assyria as his rod to discipline his children. And so World War I, Assyria rose up against Jacob, and that didn't wake them up. They didn't change their behavior.
Now, you need to clarify. When you're talking about – we have the Assyrians.
Assyria, modern-day Assyria is Germany.
How do you make that connection?
Well, that's not a difficult connection to make if you do the research and look at the details and analyze where these people migrated over time, and you study the oral culture and you study the archaeology, and if you go to the Pergamon Museum in Berlin and look at the Ishtar Gates, which were moved from Babylon to Germany, and you look at them, it's not difficult using a number of very good litmus tests and see that modern-day Germany are the original Assyrians of the Assyrian Empire, which headquarters was in Nineveh. And you recall in the Bible, it was Jonah who was sent to Nineveh,
right,
to wake them up to their impending doom should they not change their behavior and the way they live.
And the Assyrians were the ones that that took the
took
tribes,
Israel,
the tribes into captivity.
The house of Israel into captivity.
That's right.
That's right. In 722 to 718, roughly, B.C.
These are the original Assyrians.
These are the original
from
Germans.
From the Fertile Crescent,
exactly.
Modern-day
yeah,
Iraq,
exactly.
Later Babylon,
yeah.
Babylon and so forth.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So in 2017, Nelson Thal is here with us, media scientist. So in 2017, what is supposed to happen then? Are we talking about the second coming, or are we talking about the beginning of the end times?
Well, remember, first of all, the Creator in the Bible makes it clear that he does nothing without telling his servants, the prophets, about what he is going to do. But he doesn't give definite dates. But we do know that 2017 is the 6,000-year point,
right,
and that promises were made to mankind, to Adam, to give them a period of time. So obviously, now even though in the New Testament says, except those days be shortened, there shall no flesh be saved alive, still we believe, scholars believe that the 2017, the full 6,000 years will be given to mankind. But once the 6,000 years is up, you're going to have a period of time leading up to the Great Tribulation and to the Day of the Lord. The Great Tribulation is 2.5 years. The Day of the Lord is 1 year. The whole thing is 3.5 years. And of course, what you watch for is the fall of Satan, where Christ said he saw Satan fall like lightning. So after 2017, you want to watch for the fall of Satan, because Satan mounts his last attack on heaven, is thrown down like lightning, and it comes down and is now prisoner on the earth and goes after as many human beings as he possibly can.
Well, where in this timeline do we see the ascendance of the Antichrist?
Well, exactly. Well, let's go through the – what you'll have is you'll have the fall of – the fall of Satan to the earth. And Daniel makes it clear that from the fall of Satan to the second coming is 1,335 days, okay, in Daniel 11. So from so there's 1,335 days from the fall of Satan to the earth. At 1,260 days, you have the beginning of the Great Tribulation. So there's from 1335 to 1260, roughly 75 years, where 75 days,
right,
where you will have persecution of the saints and of all Christians.
This is we're coming up on a break. You said something there that sort of threw me, or has thrown me into some confusion, because you said that Satan will be thrown out of heaven.
Yeah.
But my understanding was that already happened a long time ago, and that we are told that, you know, the world is ruled by Satan. We've been living under Satan's rule. So now all of a sudden you're telling me that this is yet to happen in the future. Let's come back and pick up on that point. Let's straighten that out, because, Nelson, I'm confused about that. And then we'll continue to talk about geopolitics through the filter of the Bible. Nelson Thal, my guest, right here on The Conspiracy Show. My name is Richard Serrett. Don't go away. And we are back with Nelson Thal, media scientist and the archivist for the late Marshall McLuhan, communications guru. And we're talking geopolitics through the filter, if you will, of Scripture, the Bible, biblical prophecy. So explain something to me. You mentioned that we need – one of the signs is we need to look for Satan being thrown out of heaven like lightning. Now, again, my understanding is, as limited as it is, that this happened in the past, that Satan was cast out, you know, ages ago, and that the world is being run by the Prince of Darkness. Now you're telling me that this event is to happen in the future. So, Nelson, you've got some explaining to do.
Okay, well, exactly what originally happened was this, that Lucifer covered the very throne of heaven with his wings. And when iniquity was found in him, he was removed from the throne, removed from the throne room, but not cast down as a prisoner on the earth. As a matter of fact, if you look in the book of Job, he regularly came with other angels and had an audience with the Lord. So when he was removed from covering the very throne of God, that's when all the material universe that he had created went dark and went into a state of death. And that is what we see today when we look out at the universe. If you take a look at Genesis 1:1, it says, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth.
Right.
Right?
So in other words, Satan was initially
just removed from the
throne.
Lost
favor with God.
Lost
and was no
favor.
Longer his favorite advisor.
And could not just come for an audience whenever he chose. He had to wait till he was summoned.
All right.
Okay? At the end time, when he mounts a final attack on heaven, that's when he'll be thrown down to the earth, cast to the earth, and the earth will become his prison. Now, it's important to realize that Genesis 1:1 says, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And then Genesis 1:2 says, the earth was without form and void, and darkness was on the face of the deep. Now, when God creates things, he doesn't create things with void and darkness. So why is it void and dark in Genesis 1:2? Well, what's happened here is Genesis is the story of the recreation of the earth after Satan's fall the throne.
All right.
That's why in verse 2 it says the earth was without form and void, because that's what happened to it after the monumental mega battle between God and Satan when Satan was thrown off the throne.
Ah, okay.
So this is not the creation chapter as it's thought of, because the earth, if it's without form and void, God doesn't create anything that's darkness. He's light and form and
all right, we're up to speed on that.
Right. So now
the tribulation.
Yeah, the tribulation. Now, the Great Tribulation is a 2.5-year period.
It's 2.5. All right.
Yes. The Great Tribulation begins with the fifth seal. You have the first four seals of the book. Remember, in the book of Revelation, there's a scroll. And whoever can open the scroll can end man's misrule over the planet. And there's silence in heaven because no one can be found. There's tears in heaven. No one can be found to open the seals. Finally, the Lamb of God, which is Jesus Christ, comes forward and is found worthy to take the scroll and open it up. And he can open it up. And the first four seals are the white horse, red horse, black horse, pale horse. That's the horseman of the Revelation. Then the fifth seal is the martyrdom of the saints and the great tribulations. Now, in time, that would happen sometime after Satan's fall. And with 12,
when he's cast down.
When he's cast down
right.
to the earth.
Okay. Now, and the rise of the Antichrist.
The rise of the Antichrist would then come at some point probably prior to that. I have to say probably, because once again, the Bible is silent on, doesn't go into every single thing. You know, otherwise, you know, if the master of the house told the servant when he was going to return, he would just sit around and do nothing up until a few days beforehand, and then all of a sudden he would do all the work that was required.
Right. Right.
So,
okay. So let's look at geopolitically what's going on,
right.
and yep. see if there are any hints in the Bible about this. Let's look, for example, at ISIS and the reemergence of the caliphate in the Middle East. Is there anything in the Bible that would, prophesy that occurrence?
Yes. The rise of an aggressive fundamentalist Islamic power is prophesied in the Bible. At the time of the end, the king of the south shall attack him, which is a power located north of the king of the south. And in the Bible, directions are all from Jerusalem. So south means south of Jerusalem.
Right.
North means north of Jerusalem. So and if it comes out of the north of Jerusalem, before the Isles, before you get to the Isles, you're looking at Germany. So Bible scholars recognize that the king of the north is the United Europe, the resurrected Holy Roman Empire. The king of the south is a caliphate, Presently, the whole Islamic world in the Middle East, North Africa, is being enveloped by, as we know, a wave of a resurgent Islamic fundamentalism. And what will come out is prophesied, the king of the south is a final leader over these reinvigorated Muslim nations, and he'll be a tremendously powerful religio-political false messiah or Mahdi.
All right. And then the king of the north would be presumably what? Someone like a Merkel or?
A Habsburg probably is what Bible students and Bible scholars and leaders of the true church suggest. It'll be a probably somebody who has been family was there before, like a Habsburg.
So not necessarily an elected official like a Merkel. It'll be one of the old families.
It'll be even though he may run into politics, but it'll be a very powerful leader like Hitler, a very, very a man who can move the crowds, because when these demon spirits go into these men and work with them, they're able to manipulate and sway the millions and like we saw with Hitler in the crowds.
Are you saying that there will be a king of the north and a king of the south and both will be antichrists?
No, they won't be antichrists. They just will be two separate kings, and the king of the south will push at the king of the north, and the king of the north will overflow and defeat the king of the south and then occupy the Holy Land.
So this is what's going on geopolitically at the time of the emergence of the Antichrist.
Exactly.
All right.
Exactly.
Now, what then would you make of, for example, what some see as the aggressive tendencies of Vladimir Putin and Russia?
Gog and Magog in Ezekiel 38 attack, if you look at it, and they come against unwalled villages and a people at peace. That attack of that 200-man army of Gog and Magog comes in the latter times of the millennium.
Okay. And Gog and Magog are what, two villages?
Gog and Magog are Russia. Basically, Gog and Magog are Russia, China.
All right. And they're going to?
They're going to mount an attack on the kingdom of God is headquartered in Jerusalem during the millennium. Not quite sure the date, but it says in the latter time. Not the end times, not the end time, which is before the return of Christ, but in the latter times of the millennium.
Right, and we're not there yet.
Yeah, because, and that's all. Yeah.
Because that is inching very close towards the final battle of Armageddon, is it not?
Well, Armageddon comes at Christ's coming.
Right.
At his coming. So Christ comes with the seventh seal. We talked about the fifth seal, Revelation 6, 9 to 11, is the martyrdom and great tribulation. Then there's the heavenly signs, Revelation 6, verse 12 to 17, and then the seventh seal, which is made up of the seven trumpets, and the seventh trumpet is the second coming.
All right.
So there's the seven trumpets as part of the seventh seal. The last trumpet is the second, ushers in the second coming of Christ. And then the seventh trumpet with his coming, then he brings in the seven last plagues, which Revelation 16, and you can look Revelation 16 verses right through from 2 to 21, is and that's all administered on Christ's enemies by Christ at his second coming.
Now, here's an interesting point. Someone raised this at a conference I was at recently,
yeah.
And he was arguing that, I mean, I know that in the Bible there are prophecies about the end times and when to look for them, signs in the sky and so forth, and wars and rumors of war.
Yeah.
And people tend to think that we're living in a very violent age. But if you actually look at the number of armed conflicts in the world, which really peaked around in the 1970s towards it was still in the midst of the Cold War. But in many respects, we're living in relative peace right now.
Yeah, there's
it's very quiet.
It is.
I mean, ISIS aside and the Ukraine-Russian conflict.
Absolutely. I mean, certainly none of the major deaths we're just getting the early, distant, early, very, very distant early warnings of this, which is about to come. We're in the beginning of sorrows.
Okay. Now, what else is happening geopolitically that you'd like to comment on that sort of squares up or lines up with biblical prophecy?
Well,
we talked about ISIS and the emergence of a caliphate. We talked about Putin. What else?
Let me just go through and rattle off these 14 signs from a great book written by a man by the name of Dr. Roderick Meredith. But the first is wars and violence and lawlessness. The second is drought and famine. Now we're starting to see a lot of drought and in the United States. Floods and drought and fires. The third is earthquakes and other natural catastrophes. And we're seeing that regularly. If you follow Suspicious Observers, is a great site, by the way. Then we're going to have disease epidemics is the pale horse. The rise of an aggressive fundamentalist power, we mentioned. The sixth is an ascendant European Union seeks global primacy. And that we're just starting to see the early stages as the vacuum left by the United States as its power is taken away as a result of Jacob's trouble. That vacuum, now the Germans are starting to say they need to arm up and have an army, the Japanese also, right?
Well, we are coming up onto another break, but to that point about the emergence of perhaps the reemergence of the Holy Roman Empire, as some have suggested, if you look at what's happening right now, some might argue quite the opposite is happening in Europe with Greece. And the negotiations that went on there and rumors of a Grexit. And it would seem, even I think to a casual observer right now, that the European Union is really on the precipice, that it could go either way. It could totally collapse.
Yeah, the answer to that is this, that the European Union is just a manifestation on the surface right now of the – remember, it all goes down to the 10 toes made of miry clay and iron, Nebuchadnezzar's dream. The last kingdom, the resurrected, would be made up of iron and miry clay. So it wouldn't be totally strong. It would be a little bit as strong as iron, but iron and miry clay don't mix. So Greece is like the miry clay.
All right. I'm sure the mighty Aphrodite would be interested to know that Greece is the miry clay. All right. We will come back. Nelson Thal is here with us. We are talking Jacob's Troubles and End Times Biblical Prophecy on The Conspiracy Show. Don't go away. We are back with media scientist Nelson Thal. It's been a while, but he's back for the full hour, and we're delighted to have him. This is fascinating stuff, Nelson. I always love delving into the Bible with you and looking at the headlines through this biblical filter. All right, so we were talking briefly before the break about the European Union and how that might fit into end time. So it's going to have to... That situation is going to have to resolve itself one way or the other. And what do the researchers suggest will happen? That the European Union will emerge triumphant despite the situation in Greece? Are these the 10 kings that are talked about in the Bible?
Absolutely. These are the 10 kings in the book of Daniel, he interpreted Nebuchadnezzar's dream. He was the Hitler of his day. He was the world emperor of his day. And he had a dream. The Creator God gave him a dream. And the dream was to show him what would happen right down to the coming of Christ. From Babylon through Persia, Greco-Macedonia, each part of this statue that Nebuchadnezzar saw, the head was of gold, the chest of silver, the belly of brass, the legs of iron, with the two legs, the two sides, the Eastern Roman Empire and the Western are the two legs going down to the feet of iron and miry clay. What I'd say is when you're trying to watch for it day by day, we're not going to see it day by day, because when the Roman Empire fell, it didn't fall literally overnight. It took time for the system to just deteriorate. In running the tape backwards and in building this, it's going to take a while for the building blocks to come together. And it's like a Rubik's Cube. One's going to come in and then it'll go out and in and out. And as this thing goes through a metamorphosis, it's going to eventually coagulate. I'd say, just remember in Terminator when the when the liquid robot slowly comes back together and rises out of the puddle.
Right.
I think that's the same sort of thing. You can't really tell until at the end you'll see, oh my, it's come together and it's visible. But if you look what's going on in Europe today and you look at the EU and you look at all the different regulations and remember there is the Berlin Committee, which is a 10 nations form an executive committee now of the EU. So there's 21, but they're all controlled by 10.
Hmm, some might say
it's
controlled
by one.
Called
the Berlin Executive. Yeah, controlled by one.
Let's see if we can make any sense of some of these huge trading blocks that are forming. I mean, the European Union is certainly one, but we also have the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and we have, of course, you know, North American Union and rumors that that's going to be even further entrenched, this North American Union. What does the Bible have to say about that?
Well, it says in Revelation 18, it says, "For all nations have drunk of the wine of the wrath of her fornication. The kings of the earth have committed fornication with her, and the merchants of the earth have become rich through the abundance of her luxury." So you have here a great religio-political trading system known as Babylon the Great, which starts – this modern Babylon is now in the process of forming in Europe. It will be a very sophisticated, wealthy system that will soon dominate most of Europe, yet it will be heavily influenced, of course, by Satan.
Okay. But we want to get around to North America as well. We just got about a minute.
Well, North America, Jeremiah says, "Alas, for that day is great, so that none is like it, and it is the time of Jacob's trouble, but he shall be saved out of it." Basically, Jacob's trouble is where God uses his rod of iron, Assyria, to discipline his children because of Sabbath breaking and idolatry. And so these people once again are going to be going into captivity. What did that mean? It means Beverly's Hills Housewives will become Cairo cleaning ladies. It's going to be rough, Rich. It's going to be rough for them. And the book of Ezekiel shows that a third are burned up in the nuclear war. A third fall by the sword. And another third go into captivity. And of the entire Jacob's house, only less than 10% are left alive. So remember, Jacob's house is Britain, America, France, Northeastern Europe, Australia. So you add up the population, if it comes to 450 or 500 million, means that less than 50 million will be left alive when it's done. So we are in, unfortunately, for some very, very big headaches and deaths.
Okay, we'll take a time out, come back with Nelson Thal. I want to find out about the why North America and parts of Europe and so forth are considered parts of the lost tribes. We'll do that. Nelson Thal talking biblical prophecy on The Conspiracy Show. Stay with us. All right. You said something very interesting before the break, Nelson. You always say something interesting, but you really tweaked my interest when you talked about the Jacob's troubles and what's going to happen to North America. And that God will use the Assyrians again, as he did in the Old Testament, against God's people. So why do you connect that to North America?
Okay. Well, basically, the descendants of Abraham was prepared to sacrifice his son Isaac for the Lord, and as a result was given great promises. God promised that he would use this one man. Remember, of all the people on the earth at that time, you're dealing now with just one man, Abraham.
Mm-hmm.
And he was promised that his descendants would become as numerous as the sand of the sea and the stars in the sky, and they would control the gates of the world, that they would have a world-ruling empire, and the sun would never set on their land. Now, that wasn't fulfilled by the Jews. The Jews aren't numbered more than the sands of the sea.
No.
The Jews didn't control the gates of the world. The Jews didn't become have such a large empire that the sun never set on their empire. All they have is the present day modern day Israel. But if you take a look at Joseph's descendants, and the Bible makes it clear that the name Israel was passed on to Joseph and his descendants, who aren't Jews. Remember, Judah was Joseph's brother.
Right.
So the descendants of Judah, the blood descendants of Judah, are known as Jews.
Right.
But the blood descendants of Reuben, Judah's brother, aren't Jews. They're Reubenites.
Right.
And Reuben today, the Reubenites went across Europe from the time of 721 BC and eventually settled and went right across Europe and eventually became northern France. And France became the descendant of the Reuben Empire. That's the tribe of Reuben. The tribe of Dan is not difficult to find. They went across through the ocean and the sea routes and the river routes, and they left their name on the Danube. And you've got the Danmark, right? Now, the descendants of Joseph, Ephraim, Manasseh, they got the bulk of the blessing, the birthright blessing, and so they created a union of their brothers, and that became the Union Jack. That's the flag. Uh-huh. The name Israel was given to Ephraim, which means aristocrat, and he settled in the Isles in the coastlands. The British Isles.
So the Union Jack, the Jack is for Jacob.
Is the union of Jacob's brothers. That's right, Union Jack. And a matter of fact, if you want to go even deeper for a minute, if you look in the Bible, you'll see that when Jacob blessed his grandchildren, Ephraim, Manasseh, Ephraim was the younger and Manasseh was the older, and he didn't put his right hand on the older Manasseh as he was supposed to. He crossed his hands and his right hand went on the head of Ephraim, and he said, and Joseph tried to correct his father, Jacob, and say, no, father, don't cross your hands. This one is the older. And he said, I know my son. I know Manasseh's older. He will be a great nation, but his brother will be greater than he. So Ephraim is Britain, and Manasseh is the United States. And if you look at the English flag, you get the cross,
uh-huh.
which is how Jacob crossed his hands.
Oh, this is good stuff.
The Union Jack, the Union of Jacob. So this is secret information that just the Queen knows and those around the British crown. And as typical, it's right out there under everybody's nose in every Bible, but nobody really takes the time to study into it.
And you told me once, Nelson, that I believe it was you. I'm sure it was you. when we talk about America and we talk about Yankees.
Okay, let's go into that.
Yes.
Yes.
That's a Hebrew word, is it not?
It's a Yiddish word. Exactly. And it's the Yiddish word for Jacob is Yankel.
Yankel.
And they're the children of Jacob via Joseph.
So when the Bible is talking about Israel,
yes,
it's talking about all the nations of the world.
There are 70 nations,
wherever
but it's
the
only
lost
talking
tribes
about
went.
The last 10 tribes. And, of course, look, three tribes – well, there were 12 tribes. The two tribes of Judah and Benjamin made up the country called Judah,
right,
in the house of Judah. They split the whole country, which was called Israel, with 12 tribes, split into two different countries.
Right.
Judah to the south with the capital Jerusalem,
right,
with the two tribes Judah and Benjamin. The other 10 tribes in the north form the Israel, the nation Israel, with its headquarters, its capital at Samaria.
Right.
They're the ones that first went into captivity in 722 BC when the Assyrians invaded and took them out of that land.
Right.
They then went across. For instance, you take a look. Now, for instance, remember Abraham's great-grandfather was known as Heber. That's where the word Hebrew comes from.
Right.
Okay. Now, the word Iberia in Spain, the Hebrews, the Israelites brought the name Hebrew and became Iberia on their way to the Isles. They stayed for a few hundred years in Spain. Then they moved up to Scotland where you have the Hebrides.
Ah.
So Hebrew again. And of course, you've got the British means covenant man, Yankees.
Right.
That's where America gets the name the Yankees.
So Canada is part
Ephraim.
Part Ephraim.
And Quebec is mostly Reuben and Simeon.
Okay. All right. So this partnership, now that we have rumors of a North American union, would make sense from a biblical standpoint
because the two brothers, Ephraim and Manasseh, are brothers. They're going to get together as their foreign outside enemies get stronger. Two brothers who used to separate themselves, you know as well as I do, what happens in any skirmish where you have two individual brothers, if their enemies come together. They come together. And so the odds are is that, now the Bible doesn't really go into what will happen in North America culturally. But when you think about it and extend it, you realize tribal people don't react differently regardless of the tribe. When they're being threatened, the thugs of the tribe rise to the top, usually, not the intellectuals. It's the thugs within the tribe rise to the top. Mm. And they get together and form some sort of a protection. So instead of the security fences going around the 49th parallel to the north and south, they're going to change the security fences and go around the whole perimeter of the coast of North America as in order to become more powerful and stronger, because who needs to guard the 49th parallel? We're brothers. Let's use that energy and resources to put around the entire continent, which turns the continent into an island. And so it's vote so-and-so off the island, and the whole island mentality has gripped North America. Just look at the TV shows and the Survivor series, et cetera, et cetera.
So you mentioned that here in North America, we are in for a rough ride because we are part of the lost tribes of Israel, and we are going to be disciplined by the iron rod of the modern-day Assyrians,
exactly.
Which would tend to suggest what? Another war with Germany?
Absolutely. And it may not be an actual hardware gunpowder war. It may just be an economic warfare.
A trade war.
It could be a currency war. I mean, if they were to somehow influence the Chinese to put up all the U.S. treasury bonds for sale, I mean, I don't think it's going to be military. I think it's going to be economic. I think you'll eventually see the United States dollar severely tank.
Well, everybody that I follow in terms of economics is pointing that way, although the U.S. dollar is soaring pretty well right now. However, there is some suggestion that the Germans and the Chinese are getting together on a number of different ventures, building railroads deep into Europe, and also I think the Germans and the Russians have a great deal in common, and the Germans are quite resentful about these economic sanctions that the West, the North Americans, are trying to put on Russia, because it's hurting Germany. It's hurting Europe.
If you take a look at Psalm 83, there's a great press release in advance.
All right.
It's now talking about the enemies of the House of Israel, the enemies of America, and how they make a tumult. They have taken crafty counsel against your people and consulted together against your sheltered ones. They have said, come and let us cut them off from being a nation, that the name of Israel be remembered no more. Now remember, when it uses the word Israel here, it doesn't mean the country today of Israel.
Right.
It means the House of Israel, which is Britain and America primarily, as well as Northwestern Europe. Remember, let's just briefly point out that Finland, for instance, let's just take France is Reuben, Finland is Issachar.
How do we know that?
Well, how do we know that? In order to condense a complex study into just a few flashing insights, we know that basically from a number of factors. First of all, now we know from DNA records.
Okay.
For instance, I've been able to trace myself to the tribe of Levi, and specifically the house of Aaron. through the markers that are seen in the DNA.
Okay.
Likewise, the French now, they can tell with their Reuben. But not just before there was the science, there was the language.
Yes.
There was the archaeology. There was the oral culture.
Yeah, state symbols.
Symbols.
Right.
If you look at the symbols of the nations of Europe, especially Norway, Finland, Sweden, I mean Britain, England, et cetera, Netherlands, the Dutch, you can see all of that there within their flags and within their oral culture, et cetera. So there's lots of proof as to where these tribes went.
We're just about out of time. We've got less than 2 minutes, Nelson. The recent negotiations, the deal, the nuclear arms deal with Iran. What anything there that might be may have been prophesied in the Bible?
Well, we do know that basically there's going to be a time of war, such as never was, nor ever has ever been, nor ever will be. And obviously, we're going to have a tremendous amount of atomic and nuclear warfare. I separate the two because there's fission bombs. We don't hear about them. Fission bombs are bombs that don't take out a whole country, et cetera. But there's neutron bombs, fission bombs that take out a city. So, I mean, they want to be able to take out these cities and leave it so that they can move in after the people are done.
Now, we'll have to this has been a remarkable hour. Listen, I can't thank you enough for coming in. Thank you so much. Nelson Thal. All right. Back next week with a brand new program. Hope you'll be along for the ride. In the meantime, don't be afraid. There's nothing concealed that won't be revealed and nothing hidden that won't be made known. What you hear in the dark, speak in the light. What I say in a whisper, proclaim from the housetops. Move over, Aphrodite. I'm coming home. Good night.
This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.